Well, good afternoon. My name is Duff Sundheim, and I'll be your mediator today. And welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. Today, we have the distinct pleasure of having the chance to hear the views of Steve Forbes. Steve is the chairman and editor-in-chief of Forbes Media. He's a former Republican presidential candidate and the author of a new book, which George referenced, Reviving America, How Repealing Obamacare, Replacing the Tax Code, and Reforming the Fed Will Restore Hope and Prosperity. As chairman of Forbes Media, Mr. Forbes oversees Forbes Magazine with a circulation of nearly 1 million readers in the United States, and over 5 million worldwide. In both 1996 and 2000, as I mentioned, Mr. Forbes campaigned vigorously for the Republican nomination for the presidency. Key to his platform was a flat tax, medical savings accounts, a new Social Security system for working Americans, parental choice of schools for their children, term limits, and a strong national defense. To give us his thoughts on the political and economic climate in the United States and the world, as well as how to make America more prosperous in the years ahead, please welcome our special guest, Steve Forbes.
Well, thank you very much, Duff, for those very kind words, and thank all of you for coming out here today. Thank the Commonwealth Club for making this possible, where you can have a civil discussion, go longer than 5 seconds on a soundbite. So this is not a bad thing. But as Duff indicated, I'm going to make some remarks today about the economy, where we're at, where we're going, what is happening around the world, why we seem to be stuck in this rut, not only here but around the world. I know that in the Q&A, obviously, the elections are going to come up, so let me say some words now if there are no consequences, this election would be a great show. I mean, you couldn't have scripted this thing. It just gets more eye-rolling. The reason you couldn't have scripted it is no one would have thought it could have been possible that something like this would unfold. And even the third-party candidates, you heard, I love Gary, who's running the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico. He served as governor years ago, and he was the only governor to support me when I ran for president. All the others went for George W. So I've always thought Gary was a genius, you know, discernment. But when he tripped up, as can happen, on Aleppo in Syria, that interview, somebody said, this shows how politics can be pretty cutting. Somebody said, Gary is in favor of legalizing marijuana. Somebody said, well, he's a good example of why we shouldn't legalize marijuana. I mean, that's the kind of cut and thrust that you have these days. And so, it's not just the two major candidates. All of them would be good on Saturday Night Live, but you never would expect to see it unfold this way. And so what it just boils down to, and then I'll get to the economy, it's really, in terms of the two major party candidates, third term versus temperament. Even though Obama's favorabilities have risen up as he's been less in the news, the fact of the matter is that 70% of the American voters say in surveys they're not happy where the country is economically. They're not happy with what's happening around the world. So normally that would be the kiss of political death in terms of a person running on the record of the incumbent. And so that's third term. Temperament, is this man, Donald Trump, qualified? Does he have the temperament to sit in the big chair next to the button? And that's why you see her assaults on his temperament, all the ads about is he got the stability, the discipline to do it. It all focuses on that. So it's third term versus temperament. And whoever dominates the narrative, especially with these debates, will win the election. By the way, if you want a good commentary on what is unfolded, You might refer to an interview in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago with the creator of Dilbert, Scott Adams. Dilbert. Now, why would the Journal interview a comic strip writer about the presidential election? Well, the creator is very interested in communication, studies psychology, and he predicted well over a year ago, in July or August of 2015, when Trump was still regarded as a fringe candidate, he predicted publicly, he said, Trump will win the Republican nomination and he'll win the election. So the interviewer said, well, how did you come up with that before anyone else? All the political pundits missed it. And he said, because of the way Trump was framing people and debate. And he said the regulars, the conventional wisdom, was missing it completely. He said, look at their nicknames in terms of Jeb Bush. Now, Jeb Bush had a great record as governor of Florida and calm demeanor, the kind of thing you think you'd want in a crisis, appealing. He's not going to go crazy. And so what does Trump call him? Low energy. And he said by low energy, it started to frame how you saw the man. And so suddenly, instead of a calm demeanor, you saw a guy, he needs some espresso in the morning. Doesn't he go to Starbucks? I mean, what's the matter here? And on down the line, talking about Ted Cruz, Lion Ted. Well, Cruz already had a problem of appearing, and something he couldn't overcome, that he can't quite believe everything he says. True or false, that was the impression. As somebody said, he strikes you the kind of person who sells repossessed Chevrolets. And so when he called him Lion Ted, that's how you started, without you even knowing it, framed how you saw the person. And so Adam said he did a twofer with Hillary Clinton, calling her Crooked Hillary. Well, crooked, okay, crook. But also, crooked also means you're bent over, you're decrepit, which gets to this whole health thing that you can't do. And he said nobody realized what was happening. And there are other things going on which you didn't touch on, but then the interviewer said, long story short, he said, well, now she's even or ahead of some polls, so what happened? And Dilbert said, well, back in June, he said, I noticed a difference in the Hillary Clinton campaign. Not her, she's still a terrible candidate, but in the way they're doing their messaging. So I knew something had happened. He said, I looked and I found the person who was making it happen. He calls him Godzilla. You wouldn't recognize the name, but this fellow worked with Obama in 2012 in characterizing Romney. So this guy got what Trump was doing. And then Dilbert said, you saw it the day after the Republican convention, after Trump's acceptance speech. The next day he said, Hillary Clinton and all of her surrogates used one word to describe Trump's acceptance speech. Dark. Dark. Very evocative. That there's a element to this character you don't want in the big chair, using the word dark. And so you're going to see more of this kind of labeling in a way that people hadn't realized before. It frames how you see the world, how you see people. And one reason it's been hard to do with Trump is that the conventional wisdom people overlook the fact that he had the highest name recognition when he came into the race, higher than Hillary Clinton. Everybody knew him. And they saw him on TV, not in a variety of roles, but always as a figure of authority. Put aside the joke that he's the only one who fired people that didn't work for him, but he was always the person you appealed to in the show, the authority. So he had this authority aura. So even if he seemed to be doing crazy things, the fact that he was in real estate, even more than high tech, real estate is tangible. You can give a speech, but speeches don't make buildings rise up. Speeches don't get the golf courses built. So he did tangible things. So maybe he's crazy, but he makes things happen. So the tangibility, even more than software, helped him. And this is what his opponents overlooked. And so let me get to the economy. But his 16 opponents on the Republican side, and this shows you why you read histories of World War I, why when it was clear what machine guns were doing, what heavy artillery were doing, why did they still send men right up the hill and to get slaughtered? Why didn't they change more? Why didn't they learn faster? Human nature oftentimes takes a very long time to adjust to a new reality. And you saw it on the Republican side. 16 candidates, not one fundamentally changed his or her strategy with the rise of Trump. You'd think if something phenomenal happens, you'd think, okay, back to the drawing board. It's not working the way we thought it would. None of them changed. They all had the same idea, oh, he'll implode, I'll just stand by the side and pick up the pieces. And they also never did, they should have talked to Dilbert, relate their proposals in a way that people could have something to take away, something that meant something to them. For example, Jeb Bush had a tax plan. He said he wanted a 4% growth in the economy, 4% GDP growth. I understood what he meant by 4% GDP growth, but to most people you say 4% GDP, it sounds like a hair formula, Rogaine with 4% GDP makes the hair grow fast. He never reduced it in a way that somebody could say, okay, I get what you're saying, I see how this is going to improve the country, my life. They never brought it down to a level where people could understand it. So it was all abstract. And so they all went down like bowling pins, all 16 of them. They never knew what hit them. So the bottom line on this is who's going to set the narrative? And they both have serious flaws. I mean, why the other day, after seeing what happened to Mitt Romney in 2012 when he used the 47%, you look at the surveys of Romney in 2012, he won on the surveys on competence, won on the surveys on handling the economy. And the economy was troubled then as it is today. He won on surveys in terms of handling foreign policy. All the things you'd think would mean victory, but he lost. The one thing he didn't win on was the question, does he understand people like me? Does he understand the life I lead? 82% said no. And that's how the Godzillas killed him in that campaign. He's not simpatico with real people. Killer. So she goes out at a fundraiser like Romney was, where he used the 47, and she talks about the deplorables. Now you're seeing T-shirts. I'm one of the deplorables. She's been around Bill for 40 years. You'd think some of it would rub off on what you do. So on this thing, yes, if you held the election today, Trump would win. But if you held the election 3 weeks ago, she would have won. So as they say, stay tuned. Stay tuned. And the question is, okay, let's get to the economy and why we're at where we're at, why people are so dissatisfied, and the numbers coming out, news yesterday was very disappointing, and so this economy is still stuck in second gear, and we're doing better than the rest of the world. It's like a baseball player hitting 250 and winning the batting title. It's pretty poor, but everyone else is doing an even poorer job. You look around the world. Japan, going to another recession. Been that way for 25 years. They have their ups and then they go back down again. Can't get out of it. China, obviously having problems. Can they do major reforms? But right now, they've got real challenges. Europe, enough said. And I'll get to that in a moment on the breakup of the European Union. Latin America, Brazil, largest economy in Latin America. A few years ago, people thought, by golly, Brazil's coming to its own. Now in a severe depression of political crisis. They just threw out one president, but corruption is seen as rampant, and so that's a troubled country, and if Brazil's in trouble, even though it speaks Portuguese, the rest of Latin America is going to be in trouble. So you look around the world, and you have a few bright spots, semi-bright spots, Britain, Sweden, and some others, but overall, it's a pretty poor place. And so what is going on? And to say that some people do, like Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, oh, we're going through secular stagnation, as if it's some alien thing that's come down, there's nothing we can do, like one of these movies, oh, they're taking over, the secular stagnationists are taking over, nothing we can do. It's nonsense. What we're going through is a result of policy errors, major mistakes, misdiagnosis of what the problems are. The nice thing is mistakes can be corrected. Mistakes can be corrected. So let me quickly hit some of the big things. Obviously, there are a lot of things that have to be done, but in the book I hit three of them. So let me just quickly hit what they are. One, of course, is going to be very big next year, no matter who wins the election, is health care. No one is happy with what has happened. Costs are still going up. You may get one of these plans on the exchanges, whatever is left. You may get a nice premium subsidy, depending on your income. But the deductibles are crazy. $5,000, $8,000, $10,000, $12,000. So a lot of people, yeah, I got the insurance, but I'm paying more out of pocket now than ever before. And so you go to, and even before Obamacare rose up because the system had some flaws. And one thing to keep, and so that raised the question, What is going on? Why is it when you go to the hospital, and we have the best health care overall in the world, you see it in cancer survival rates, so it's not the quality of the overall care in the country, but something is wrong. You go to the hospital, even though you've got some great people, you feel things are out of control. I mean, it's anxious enough to go there, but you wonder, do the specialists talk to each other? Do the hospitals, when they change, talk to each other? What is going on? And you almost feel you have to have a friend there or a relative there to make sure something doesn't go wrong. That's crazy. So that raises the question, what is wrong with healthcare? And the quick answer is, well, we want too much of it. People like me are getting older. We want more of it. But that raises the basic question. Why is demand for healthcare considered a crisis when demand for everything else in this economy is considered a great opportunity? People want more software, more apps. Some people nearby will be glad to help you out. You want more cars, manufacturers, Detroit, around the world, glad to help you out. So what's with healthcare? Why is demand for healthcare considered a disaster, whereas demand for anything else is considered a great growth opportunity for entrepreneurs to come in and meet the needs, come up with innovations? The answer is we don't have real free markets in healthcare. We have pieces of it, but we don't have real free markets. And the proof of it is it's all third party. It's government, Medicare, Medicaid, it's insurance companies, employers, patient, almost a sideshow. And the proof of it is that we don't have real free markets. You go to a clinic or hospital and you ask in advance what the treatment's going to cost, you're going to get a very strange look. It means one of two things. Either you're uninsured or you're crazy. Why would you want to know the price? You go to the hospital, what's going to cost? Oh, don't worry about it. Insurance will take care of it, and what you owe, you'll get a bill. So 5 years later, you're still getting these complicated things. What's this all about? And so it's all third party. It's all third party. The patient is not the customer. And the proof of it is not just prices. And by the way, on prices, to show how crazy the system is when it's third party, not consumer-driven, patient-driven. I went to New Hampshire a few weeks ago, met with an entrepreneur, and he related a story. He went to a cardiologist a couple of years ago for a heart condition, and cardiologist said, you're going to have what they call a nuclear stress test to show how the blood's flowing or some darn thing. And so in all innocence, the entrepreneur asked, how much is it going to cost? Doctor said, I have no idea. Well, this guy, being an entrepreneur, which means you don't take things as they are, went out on his own, got the code, went to 20, 25 different hospitals and clinics in the region, and got the prices. And they and the test is the same everywhere. It's not as if somebody has a BMW test versus a used car test. It's all the same. They range from $1,100 to $6,300. Same test. So he goes back to the doc and says gives him the information and says, even though I could go 20 miles to get the $1,150 test, he said, there's one nearby. I think I'll just do that. It's $1,400. Cardiologist says, what? This costs $1,400? He said, I never knew. True story. Gets up from the desk, goes over, does some calculations, comes back and tells the entrepreneur. He says, there's less than a 2% chance this test is going to tell us anything useful. You don't really have to do it. True story. And so it's not a real market. And so when you don't have a real market, you get problems, so you do more regulations. So it becomes whack-a-mole. Problem comes, whack, 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 more problem, whack, whack, whack. So you ask a typical hospital or clinic how much time they spend on forms, gargantuan. You ask a doc how much she or he spends on doing forms and paperwork and the like. What, 25%, 35%, 50% of the time? You go to medical school, you think you're going to learn to practice medicine instead of being a glorified bureaucrat. It's crazy. It's crazy. And nobody designed it. We explain in the book how this thing rose up. But the answer ultimately is how we turn this hopeless situation into something that everyone can get benefit from is we got to get the patient in charge. You got to get real free markets. And we do it with food. I mean, food's more basic than health care. And so if people have a problem getting food, you have everything from food banks to food stamps to deal with it. There's a very systematic way to do it. Why can't we do the same thing in health care, allow real entrepreneurship, and do what free markets always do when you allow them to, turn scarcity into abundance? It can be done. It can be done. And there are basic reforms. I was talking around rarely on a radio show. One of the reforms is, how about nationwide shopping for health insurance? You live here in California. You find a policy in Idaho. Yeah, that meets my needs. Illegal to buy it. You can buy a car in Oregon. You can buy a necktie in Washington. But you can't buy the health insurance. Have nationwide shopping. Have real competition. Equalized tax treatment. You know, if you're an employer or self-employed, you get a deduction for your premiums. But if you're an individual, you don't like what the employer's offered or doesn't offer what you like, don't like the exchange like, you go out in the market, you're paying with after-tax dollars. You're already 20, 30, 40% behind the eight ball. Make it equal. And how about transparency? Let's have clinics and hospitals post prices for everything so you can go online and see what the costs are and what you're getting from it. How about posting each month, hospitals, how many patients die from infections received after they're admitted to the hospital. Thousands of people die unnecessarily. You have that information out there. I guarantee you people figure out how to reduce those rates sharply. Allow you to choose your own insurance policy. Not one size fits all. I know it's a shock, but I don't need pregnancy services in my insurance. I really don't. But it's there. It's crazy. So there are a lot of good things that can be done, and we're on the cusp of an extraordinary era in healthcare. I'm emphasizing it because it's 20% of our economy. It's personal, but big things are coming along. Not just cures and cancer. You've read about immunotherapy, or where they can won't matter in the future where the disease originates. I had cancer a few years ago. Where it originates, whether it's prostate, breast, or doesn't matter. They can do a genetic profile of you and come up with a real cure that meets your particular needs. Big things are coming, and delivery of healthcare is going to change drastically, where it's literally in your hands, in your home, and much more flexible. You see little signs of it. I'll just give you one example. Flu shots. We're in the season again. Got to get flu shots. Once upon a time, if you wanted a flu shot, you made an appointment at a clinic or a doctor. It was a big deal. Now you can get it anywhere. Go to the drugstore, go to the airport, go to the gas station, say, fill her up, do the windshield, give me a flu shot, and we're on our way. And so you're going to see that kind of flexibility. Walk-in clinics, just beginning. So the key thing is start making these reforms and turn what looks like a hopeless financial liability into the greatest growth industry ever because it is personal. And one of the strangest things is I don't understand why in this campaign, given the people's dissatisfaction, upset about health care, it's an emotional issue, why there hasn't been more discussion of it. It's not enough to say I don't like Obamacare, I don't like this, I don't like that. What are you going to do? Why there wasn't more discussion of it? And again, relating it, people all know, going to the hospital, it's not just the disease, what are the experiences? Relate to show that you can understand and make some changes that where you're in charge and you don't feel you're at sea and wondering what's going to hit you next. And so that's a huge, I hope in the debates maybe that'll get some substantive discussion. Now that Trump is doing some speeches now getting into substance, I hope he hits this in a big way and get the debate going because people want it, they desire it. Another big thing, of course, a favorite issue of mine is taxes. Thing to keep in mind about taxes, I don't have to tell this people in this state, taxes just don't raise revenue. They're also a price and a burden. The tax you pay on income is the price you pay for working. Tax on capital gains, the price you pay for taking risks that work out. Tax on profits, the price you pay for being successful. The proposition is very simple. When you lower the price of good things, like productive work, risk-taking, success, you'll get more of them. Raise the price, you get less of them. Yet all around the world, what do they want to do with all their huge liability? They want to raise taxes. It's utterly counterproductive. And it's no coincidence that in this country, states that have low tax rates generally do better over time than states with high tax rates. You see it around the world. Why is Britain doing better than the rest of the European Union? Because they've been cutting taxes. They've been reducing the size of government. And so you look at Sweden. Bernie Sanders loved it when he referred to Sweden. He obviously hadn't looked at it in 40 years because Sweden has been reducing tax rates. Sweden has been creating more private health care. Sweden's been doing all of these things. So there you have these pockets of examples. And in this country, the biggest abomination, of course, is the federal income tax code. Just to remind you again, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, which defined the character of the American nation, all of 272 words, Constitution Amendment, 7,200 words. The Bible, which took centuries to put together, 773,000 words. Now, the Federal Income Tax Code and all the attendant rules and regulations, 10 million words and rising, depending on how you calculate. 10 million. Nobody knows what's in it. IRS doesn't know. You call their hotline if they deign to answer it. The third of the time they give you the wrong answer, hold you responsible for it. Several years ago, Money Magazine did a survey. They took a hypothetical family's numbers, finances, gave the numbers to 46 different tax preparers, people considered the best in the field. And you know what they got back? 46 different returns, 46 different estimates of what the family owed, thousands of dollars of difference. This from people who make their living at the thing. If they can't do it, how do we do it? You don't say, well, I've got good software that can do it for me. As we point out in the book, depending on your circumstances, you'll get different calculations of your tax liability depending on which software you use. So even they can't get it right because it's so horrific and so vague. And that also gets the whole thing of the rule of law. If things are so vague, so complicated, that if they want to get you, they can. That just undermines social trust. You cannot have that in a republic. And so on the tax side, again, Trump came up yesterday with a decent tax plan. Not bad. But let's go all the way. Why don't we just start all over again? Just start all over again. And it's not just a issue about take-home pay and GDP. It's a moral issue. You know, the IRS estimates we spend 6 billion hours a year filling out tax forms. Experts estimate we spend $200 to $300 billion complying with this thing, this hopelessly corrupt thing. Now just imagine and all this brain power, all the smart people focused on this, and think, go back 20 years. Imagine if those tens of billions of hours, literally trillions of dollars, all this immense brain power had been applied to new products, new services, new medical devices, new cures for diseases, how much better we'd all be off today. What economists call opportunity costs is huge. So I'm hoping, despite this campaign, that when they finally sit down next year and start to discuss real tax reform, because even the Democrats in Congress, you wouldn't know it from the rhetoric, understand, at least on the business side, we got to make changes. That was evident 4 or 5 years ago. That they'll go through what they went through in 1986, last time they took a real look at the code. They sat down. Democrats wanted to get rid of all the tax shelters that had grown up in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Republicans wanted to cut tax rates. And they discovered when they sat down, they thought they'd do some tweaking. They discovered if you touch one tax shelter, you got to do all of them, or else nothing will happen. And so they swept them all out, to everyone's surprise. They made a radical cut in tax rates from 50% down to 28, cut the number of brackets from 7 to 8 down to 2. 28 and 15%. And it passed the Senate, 97 to 3. But then when they went into it, they had no idea that they were going to start a dynamic that would actually do so much good. I hope that's what happens next year, that they end up realizing if you're going to do anything, you're going to have to do a lot more than you anticipated. And we free up all of these resources to doing something productive. And because you look around the world, everything is overtaxed. Just give you one example. I mentioned Japan. Japan's highest income tax rate is 51%. Their payroll tax, you know, in this country we have FICA, Medicare, Social Security, 15.3%, you know, half you, half the employer, 15.3%. Japan, you know what it is? 35. You wonder why that country is in a rut. They keep raising taxes, raising the sales tax, and so it's a deadly spiral. Greece, same disaster. Now, one final thing before we get to the Q&A I want to touch on, and that is the Federal Reserve monetary policy. Now, I know, as I've told you, monetary policy is not the most exciting subject in the world. It's not 50 Shades of Grey. It's not some spicy thing on Netflix or, you know, some spicy scene in Games of Thrones. You know, none of that. No naked in the jungle. It's pretty mundane, but it is critically important. Critically important. Why is it critically important? Because if you don't get that right, if you don't get the money right, other things aren't going to much matter. Why? Because how do we make progress in the world? We make progress in the world by interacting with each other, transacting with each other, do it billions of times a day around the world. If we didn't trade with each other, buy and sell with each other, we'd still be in caves. That's why this attack on trade is so baffling to me. Without trade, we'd still be, you know, trying to find woolly mammoths to eat for dinner. But money makes the trading easier, much easier than barter. Imagine if we still had barter today, trying to withdraw a cow from an ATM or depositing a tractor or something. Just very, very cumbersome. And the thing to understand, before we get to the Q&A, thing to understand about money is money in and of itself is not wealth. It measures wealth. It measures value. You know, sometimes in the wintertime you go to the restaurant, you check your coat. What do you get? You get a coat check. Coat check is a piece of plastic, a piece of paper, worthless in and of itself, but it's a claim on a real product. You buy a ticket to a concert or a game, whether it's an ellipse on the computer, your handheld, or your a piece of paper, in and of itself worthless, but it's a claim on a real thing. Money measures value, the way scales measure weight, clocks measure time, rulers measure space. Money measures value, which is why we can do these transactions with strangers. And it's also a key thing to keep in mind, it's based on trust. That these worthless pieces of paper, ellipses on a computer, these token coins represent claims on real products and services. And if you start messing around with the measurement, as the Fed has been doing for years and years, you undermine the economy and you also undermine social trust. And people don't even realize how acidic and invidious a process it is. But imagine just for a moment that they decide to deal with the obesity problem by increasing the number of ounces in a pound from 16 to 32. Overnight, your weight is in half. Very, very comforting. But in the real world, it means nothing. Or imagine if the Federal Reserve was in charge of the Time Bureau. And they decide to do to clocks and watches what they do, timepieces, what they do to the dollar. They started to float the dollar. 60 minutes an hour one day in an hour, 48 minutes the next, 96 minutes the day after. We all know life would be chaotic. You know, you bake a cake. It says bake the batter 30 minutes. You have to decide, is that nominal minutes? Is that inflation-adjusted minutes? Is it a California minute? Mexican minute, Bangladesh minute. We get it, but on money, it just passes over them when you keep changing the value. And, you know, how do you make progress? You invest. Investment's key. How do you get a higher standard of living? People are always putting up capital, great new ideas, expanding existing business. But if you don't know what you're going to get paid back in, is going to be $1 cent dollar, $0.80 dollar, $1, $10, you get what we've had in recent years, less investment. It's like imagine trying to do your day if you don't know how many minutes are going to be in an hour. Just utterly inefficient. So there are things we outline in the book the Fed can do right now, long term. They've got to do what we did for 180 years and fix the dollar to gold. Gold is a ruler, by the way. Gold is a ruler. You don't use it as money. It's like a measuring stick. It has a fixed value. When you see the price fluctuate, that's the dollar fluctuating, that's the yen fluctuating, that's the euro fluctuating. For a variety of reasons which we outline in the book, it's the best thing we have to a stable value. Not perfect, but the best, 4,000 years. So when you fix it, it doesn't restrict the money supply. If you have a vibrant economy, you have more money. Just like a ruler 12 inches doesn't restrict the size of a building you wish to construct. We explain all this. It's very simple. It's not complicated. So the bottom line on all of this is, what we're going through in the world is a result of massive policy errors. But these things can be corrected. And one of the things that's been disappointing about this campaign, aside from all the fireworks and the name-calling and all that kind of stuff, is they really didn't get into. This is where I blame the 16. It's not enough to have a nice tax proposal. You got to do it in a way that people can grasp, understand, and get a real discussion going around. But the nice thing is we have frequent elections in this country. The nice thing is, even though an election may come and may go, we still can weigh in on what they do when they take office next January. And that's what we have to do. Weigh in, because what we're going through is utterly unnecessary. And let's just put a stop to it. Thank you very much.
Great job.
Thank you.
Great job.
Thank you.
Well, that was extremely enjoyable, and I learned a lot. And I also learned a lot from the questions I received from you, and I think that I really look forward to getting into that. One of the things I found interesting is the number of questions that asked about what your feelings were about the future. And I usually find that people don't ask guests what their view is of the future if they haven't found their presentation interesting. So I think that you have been very well received by this audience. In terms of the future, I rely on that famous philosopher, Yogi Berra, who said he was reluctant to make predictions, especially about the future. But notwithstanding that limitation, let's start off with what your view is of the economy going forward. And I've had a lot of specific questions asked about what is your view of the housing market, the price of oil, where do you see things going, both here in the United States and internationally, economically?
Well, economically, short term, just expect a little more disappointment. Business investment's not good. Productivity's not good. Small business confidence is not good. One of the things the Fed has done by suppressing interest rates, suppressing the price of money, is it's totally distorted and deformed the credit markets. It's very easy for government to borrow, very easy for large companies to borrow, but for small and new businesses, you have to paper it six ways to Sunday, and it's hurt the availability of credit, and it's affected the cost of credit to the very people who innovate, the very people who create the jobs. And as I said on a show earlier today, having zero interest rates is like the saying in the old Soviet Union, the health care is free, but you can't get any. For a lot of businesses, that's where we find ourselves today. So, but there are signs around that this is going to change. First of all, even the Fed inside is now grappling with what they've done for 7 years has failed. They can't quite put it like that, but there was a story in the Wall Street Journal the other day by a guy named John Hilzenrath, who's very tightly connected to people inside the Fed. You see that in the byline, you know that's somebody inside the Fed speaking. So you listen to it. Very real, starting soul searching. They realize what they're doing is not working. The reasons they came up with were all wrong because the way they see the world is all wrong, but at least they're starting to ask the question. Paul Volcker, famous head of the Fed in the late 70s and early 80s, killed the terrible inflation of the 1970s. Volcker, a couple of years ago, said, "What we're doing is not working. What we've done since we destroyed the gold-based Bretton Woods system has not worked. Getting crises, it's not worked." That's the key thing. You have to first recognize we have a problem. And I think I think we're beginning to see that on the money side. So I'm optimistic on that. And on the tax side, the fact that all the candidates on the Republican side felt they had to come up with at least a proposal on simplifying and cutting tax rates is a good thing. And I hope that, and the fact that Democrats, going back to the Bowles-Simpson Commission, appointed by President Obama in his first term, came up with proposals to simplify the code on the business side. So that idea is percolating. And on health care, visibly, we see that it's not working the way it should. So the very crisis, at least in this country, since we don't tolerate failure, we're very practical people. If something doesn't work, we're gonna search out for ways to change it. So it may not go as fast as I would like, but I'm starting to see ideas circulating more and more that give me faith that we're going to start to do things right. And the nice thing is if we get things right in this country, other countries will be quick to follow, especially in democracies. Failure is not a good formula for staying in office. We saw that in the early 80s when the U.S. did these massive tax cuts. 50 countries within a few years followed suit, including Sweden, which then had a 99% tax rate. And so, short-term, frustration. Longer-term, i.e. in the next couple of years, I think you're going to see a lot of ferment. And so if it's the right kind of debate and clashing over where we go instead of size of gloves and hands and all that kind of thing, then we know that we're going to get back on our feet.
Any specific insights in the next couple of years into the price of housing, the price of oil, the stock market valuations?
On the stock market, I'll make some observations, but I should lead with one of my grandfather's sayings. He founded our company nearly 100 years ago. He's an immigrant to this country from Scotland, one of 10 children, grade school education, but like many who came here, had dreams and ambitions, opportunity to realize. And when he started Forbes magazine, people would ask him, you know, what stocks you buy, interest rates, and all that kind of thing. And he'd respond, you make more money selling the advice than following it. So full disclosure, But on the housing side, you're starting to see a little bit of ferment now. But the best thing for housing in terms of and these average prices don't mean anything. People have different needs, and so what you want is when you get the economy moving again, you want house building, not just apartments, which have been in vogue for years, but you want all kinds of houses. And one reason why housing is so utterly unaffordable in this state, where you can buy 10,000 square feet in another state, get you a closet in this one, is because of unnecessary regulation. You can combine the best of all worlds. You can have sensible regulation, get permits fairly quickly, and that, by time, is money. And so I think when you get the economy moving, housing will do just fine at all levels, because just take a gross number, even in normal time. If we had a normal economy, we'd need 1.5 million housing starts each year just because of decrepit old housing or population increase. And we're not anywhere near that. We sometimes get sort of close to it, but it just never happens. So housing, boom, you know, growth settles a lot of problems. It really does. On oil, I don't think, unless the Fed messes up again, which is always possible since they don't know what they're doing, I don't think you're going to see the great boom in oil. But notice this. In the 1970s, none of you are old enough to remember the 70s. It's called pandering, but tried it in politics, didn't work, which is why I'm here today. But in the 1970s, oil was around $2-3 a barrel. Then suddenly went up to end of the decade, early 80s, was $38-40 a barrel. People thought we must be running out of the stuff. That wasn't shortage. That was the weak dollar. Oil is sold and denominated in dollars. So as the dollar got weaker, nominal prices of copper and everything else went up. We saw the same thing in the early part of the last decade. They started to knock down the value of the dollar. This, by the way, started under a Republican, so this is not a partisan issue. Both sides are guilty of malpractice here. And so you started to see oil go up, gold go up, silver go up, copper go up, wheat went up, soybeans went up, everything went up. And that wasn't a sudden demand for the stuff. It was the weak dollar. And then suddenly, a couple of years ago, the dollar got stronger, thanks to the Fed, but they didn't know what they were doing. And what happened to commodity prices? Kaboom. Ask Brazil. Kaboom. Ask Russia. Crashing. So I think in a normal economy, you'd see oil at 50, 60. And given the technology we have, we'll still do very well, especially on the gas side. So I think energy has a future, but what I think is ultimately destructive is when you get these violent swings. You get overinvestment, then you get disillusion, massive layoffs, bankruptcies all over the place, which we've experienced in the last 18 months, and then it takes time to rebuild. So you want stability. And on the stock market, just one quick word. Emotions are your enemy. Everyone says they're a long-term disciplined investor until the market goes down. Then, oh my God, is it too late to get out? And so since saying be disciplined in stock investing is like saying eat less and you'll lose weight, yeah, very true, good luck. But so I recommend doing this way. Do bifurcate. Have your retirement money, that just ignore it. Keep putting in your quarterly or whatever payments, whatever the schedule is, in good times and bad. Have a couple of index funds with low fees and leave it alone. For your inner Buffett, for your inner investing genius, do your non-retirement money and let your emotions run. And that way you don't wreck your retirement, but also you can see if you really are a genius. And one of the worst things you can do is when you go to a party or something, and you have your idiot brother-in-law or neighbor, he knows a jerk, and he talks about how well he's done. You say, well, that idiot can do it. Why can't he? You start making mistakes. Because psychologically, losses are a lot harder to deal with than winnings. Everyone, it's fun to talk about the weddings, but loss is very, very hard to deal with. So bottom line, do that bifurcation. Leave your, be sensible, boring to heck with your retirement money. Do the other stuff. If you have a knack for it, great, great. You've got people in the valley that are very good at that, great. But don't mix the two together, because just one thing on that. In 2007, late 2007, early 2009, we had one of the worst bear markets. Dow and S&P 500 went down 54-55%. Many stocks even worse. You had all the jokes about 101Ks and things like that. And a lot of people said, I can't stand this emotionally, and they took money off the table. Then in March of 2009, even though the world was still rotten, the market turned. We explain in the book why, but there are some technical reasons why. How many people who took money off the table got back in March of 2009, which is the beginning of one of the most extraordinary, bizarre bull markets ever? Very few. So don't be a market timer. You always hear about the right calls, especially after a crash. If all the geniuses who called it, you hear about. Just didn't hear about them beforehand. They kept it to themselves. So emotions are your enemy. Just remember that.
Well, it's interesting you say emotions are your enemy, but clearly you have energy and passion, and it comes through very clearly in your presentation. One of the people that asked a question said, does Trump really understand people like me? How do you think Trump would interact with foreign leaders? So if you could answer that, both with respect to Trump, and I think it would be interesting if you have any insight on Hillary Clinton in those regards.
Yeah, on foreign leaders, remember a couple of weeks ago, Trump went to Mexico. A huge coup, arranging a meeting with the president of Mexico, and he behaved himself. He talked about, you know, we got to find common ground. And then after the meeting, amazingly, you had podiums like they do after real leaders meet. And so the president was at one, Mexico was at one, Trump was at the other, like you normally do after two leaders, nationwide leaders meet. He was a candidate, but he was treated like he was president of the United States. And he comported himself very well. It was a coup. Oh, this guy's got the temperament. He knows how to, you know, conduct himself when real business has to be done. And, of course, that night, what does he do? He goes to Phoenix, Arizona. It's back to red meat. Put him in box. I mean, the Mexican thing told me, at least when you're dealing with the real thing, he knows that red meat's not going to work if you want to get something really done. So I hope that's a harbinger if he wins. If it isn't, then okay. You know, maybe seek asylum somewhere. But on Hillary Clinton's side, even though she's had enormous experience in the political sphere, there's a very real question, how would she do? She did not deal well with the Russians. She couldn't even convince Obama on making some changes. And remember 20 years ago when they had what they called Hillary Care? Remember when Bill Clinton proposed what ultimately became Obamacare? She, when she's putting this together, she's inviting all these experts in, she never brought in people who might have helped get this thing passed, get them buy-in. And if you knew anything about history and you're trying to get a big thing done, you know you got to bring people in, make compromises, some compromises in advance, so people feel they have a stake in making this thing work. And the classic example is Woodrow Wilson, League of Nations. When he went over to Paris for the Versailles Treaty Conference, he brought no real Republican leaders from the Senate or the House. And so there was no buy-in. He made huge other mistakes, but the whole thing came crashing down. By contrast, in World War II with Franklin Roosevelt, they made sure Republicans were brought in. I was just reading history of the Bretton Woods Conference, which set up the post-war World War II monetary system, very successful. And they made sure there was a leading Republican senator, a leading Democrat senator, leading Republican House member, leading Republican member of the Senate. So they got the bipartisanship with it. And after a hard struggle, because they were doing things that weren't necessarily popular, they got it through both the House and the Senate. And so she didn't, despite history showing that if you're going to do a big thing, you want to get buy-in, she didn't do it. Nor, by the way, did President Obama when he did Obamacare, especially after the 2008 election when the Republicans psychologically were flat on the ground. If he had made proper outreach on a stimulus program, he could have gotten 30, 40, 50 of Republican House members to go along with it. He could have gotten several senators on Obamacare to go along with it if he'd been willing to make some compromises. So with Hillary, she's got experience with foreign leaders, but again, how you interact with them, what messages you're giving, I don't know. So both of them, even though she's had a lot of experience, both of them, in my mind, are I just don't know, and that's what worries me, that they know how to handle these things, they know how to read body language, they know how to say things in a way that you don't lose face but gets a message across. Very subtle stuff, and I'm not seeing any evidence yet, either of them, that they brought in people who know how to do it. You know, when you go into an office like the presidency, there's no way you can master the whole thing. No way. So you have to bring in people who you can trust, who can do some of this to get things done. And you have to have people who understand, even if they don't like each other, they can deal. Everyone talks about Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill. Tip O'Neill was the House Speaker, Democratic House Speaker in the 80s, how they'd sit down, have drinks together, and get things done. That's the fairy tale version. They disliked each other. O'Neill was disdainful of Reagan, considered him a big dummy. And Reagan had some choice words for Tip O'Neill. But at the end of the day, both knew with their respective positions, they had to get something done. And they sat down, and even though they had personal antipathy, they did get things done. And that's what I'm looking for now. People who can sit down and figure out how you move something, as they did with Bretton Woods, even if there's not initially popular opinion, but knowing how to get people to have buy-in to move the thing forward. Long answer, but it's a very basic question in terms of success. Not just enough to say, well, here's what we need to do. You've got to figure out how you make it happen. And just one other thing, why we should teach history again, is Lincoln was a master of this during the Civil War. In terms of proposing something that initially was either new or had opposition and knew how to time the thing, even if some were frustrated how slow it was, to bring it along and make it happen and get the support so it would be enduring.
I just want to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of Northern California and our guest, noted conservative commentator and author Steve Forbes, who's giving his take on the politics of 2016 and beyond. My name is Duff Sunheim, your moderator, and you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. Now, again, keeping your crystal ball in front of you, what do you think is happening in terms of our politics today, especially from the Republican perspective? If Trump wins or loses, is this like 1964? Is it more like the Whigs of the 1850s? Are, given what's happening with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and the Democrats, are we seeing the dissolution of the two-party system? Where do you see our politics going in America?
Let me answer first on the two-party system. The two-party system will endure. It shattered in the 1850s because there's no way to deal with the whole question of slavery. So all the political parties shattered. And that's how the Republican Party was created, out of the remnants of the old Democratic Party, the old Whig Party. And the American system gets no respect, but it's been designed or evolved in a way where normally you cannot win a national election unless you put together a nationwide coalition. You can't do it as a regional candidate. You can't do it narrowly based. You got to bring a lot of people who may not have much in common or may not like much like each other together, which can either lead to mush or skills like Lincoln demonstrated. And just an example, I mentioned Lincoln. In the 1850s, when the Whigs and the traditional Democrats shattered, and plus there was third parties rise up and then they blow away, called the American Party, which was an anti-immigrant party. When we had the great wave of immigration after the Irish famine in the late 1840s, numerous German immigration because of the failed revolutions of 1848, massive immigration. And so the what they called the Know-Nothings or the Nativists or the what the formal party, the American Party, wanted to send them all back. Too many immigrants, send them away. They were legal because we had no laws then on immigration, but they aroused real antipathy. So you have the nativists. And so when the Republican Party was created, their uniting theme was stop the territorial expansion of slavery. And so who was a big constituent of the new Republican Party? Were the American Party, the Know-Nothings. Who was another big constituent of this new Republican Party? German immigrants. Now, how you keep those two groups together? Lincoln managed to do it. Or you take even more modern times, the Democratic Party, under the time of Franklin Roosevelt. You had the North, Catholic, Jewish, urban, core of the Democrat, and the South, white, segregationist, keep the blacks from the polling booth. And they were united for a while. They shattered after World War II. But so parties bring, and that's why they're always evolving. They're always evolving. So whatever happens in the election, we'll still have two parties. What they shake out into is the interesting question. If Trump wins, you're going to see some real under-the-table fighting over immigration and especially over trade. The Democrats have been anti-trade for years, anti-free trade, going back to the late 60s, early 70s. They used to be the free trade party, and the Republicans were the protectionists. That reversed. When Bill Clinton wanted to get NAFTA through, he had to rely on the Republicans to supply the votes to do it. And when Obama wanted to get some of these free trade agreements like South Korea through, he had to do it through dealing with having the Republicans do it for him. Democrats didn't want to go along. So what happens, so you're going to see some real tension on that. You're going to see some real tension on what you do about the entitlements. And Paul Ryan has his own views of things. To say that he was not enthusiastic about Trump's candidacy would be an understatement. It sort of reminds you of what the Wall Street Journal said about Trump. They said he wasn't our first choice. And he wasn't our 15th choice. And that about sums up where Paul Ryan sits. So you're going to see some real tension there. It could be creative tension, or it could be the kind of thing, if Trump is as good a negotiator as he says, they may get some useful things done through that kind of tension. But if Trump loses, it'll be a Donnybrook in terms of where the party goes on immigration, where the party goes on trade, but it'll be more out on the surface. And that'll be very interesting. I think, again, it's going to take some deaf leadership, because the reason you have this anti-immigration feeling is people feel, you know, when times are good, people really don't get upset about those things. Some do, but most don't. But when you feel you're stagnant, there's no hope for the future, we just seem to be stuck in this rut, perpetual walking pneumonia, just can't get rid of the thing, that's when the politics turns ugly. Lack of growth. You see it in Europe with the rise of the Native parties. You see it in what happened in the Democratic Party this year, or Republican Party. People are utterly dissatisfied, and they're also dissatisfied with PCism. Regardless of what happens this election, you're going to see a difference, not with the insult, but in terms of get over this idea that we're all babies and we can't hear certain words, and get some vigorous discourse and get over it. Enough of this PC stuff. Let's have some honest discussion. So I think you're going to see that regardless of what happens in the election. But on the Republican side, there are tensions that will, as happens in parties from time to time, are going to break out, either in subtle battles in Congress, if Trump wins, or out in the open if he loses. And on the Democrat side, I think you're going to start to see some rumblings saying, did we go too far left? Especially if Republicans succeed in turning around the economy. Now, they've got some good proposals, but neither one is yet. Amazingly, if he's to be believed, Trump is further along in realizing there's a problem with the Fed than the Democrats. But if they don't deal with the failures of the Fed, they got a problem. One reason I'm hopeful is that on that platform yesterday when Trump gave his speech, there's a guy sitting behind him called David Malpass, who I've worked very closely with. He understands the Fed better than anyone else out there. If he has real input, then I think we could turn this thing around. If the economy turns around, you'll see what happened in the 80s and 90s when Bill Clinton and the centrists took over the Democratic Party, started to win elections. And so depends on who wins.
Well, we have about 6 minutes left. I'd like to ask this question and then ask a question off of the question because I think it raises some important issues. The question is, what new economic systems are being explored to replace the market-based system with something more sustainable? So I think this goes to the issue of the feeling, which I think is widely held by many parts of this country, that the market system is A, not sustainable, and B, is not fair. So my question is, obviously, I tend to know where you fall on that. If you could explain not only why you feel, you know, what explain how it is sustainable and how it is fair, but also why are, is, because I agree with the market system as well, why is our side losing this issue in so many parts of America today?
Well, when you say the word markets, it sounds like some impersonal, monstrous thing out there. Markets are people. Anytime you go to the store or buy something, you're the market. So it's people's preferences. Millions, billions of times a day is the market. And so when they talk about the impersonal market, they're in effect saying, we don't like what you're doing, and we want to change it. We don't like the outcome. So in terms of markets, the thing to keep in mind, first of all, we're human beings. And so the idea that markets have brought about all this bad behavior, people were doing bad things long before Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776. You look at the Bible or some of these old histories, people were doing bad things from time immemorial. So the underside of human nature has always been with us. The question is, what kind of system channels our innate energies in a way that where you benefit, other people benefit? And so one reason why the debate on markets, the pro-marketeers always seem to lose, is they haven't engaged the moral side of free markets. They always say it works. Well, that's very practical, but if people don't feel it's really moral, that it's based on greed, it's based on, you know, profits before people, yada, 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 you're going to lose. And the fact that government programs fail, as they have with the Veterans Administration and things like that, they always say, well, we may mess things up and hurt people, but our heart is in the right place. And that is compelling. You got to deal with it. And so we wrote a book on this, but the get to the thing on markets is, in true free markets, you only succeed by meeting the needs and wants of other people. It's based on transactions. I want something, you want something from me, we make an agreement. We each get something from it. So remember, meeting the needs and wants of other people, that's what markets are about. And they are humanizing. They bring people together, what we call supply chains, hideous word, but it brings people cooperating, teams inside a company trying to get something done. And humanizing, you may not love your neighbor, but you sure want to sell to your neighbor. So you're always trying to figure out, how do I appeal to you? How do I get something to you? So in that sense, it's a moral system. And so this idea that you have commerce on one side and philanthropy on the other, you do the bad stuff on commerce and then you make up for your success, for your sins by giving it away, is a false one. Both effective philanthropy and effective commerce are meeting the needs and wants of other people. And that's why you have the paradox of the U.S., the most commercial nation ever invented, but also we're the most philanthropic nation in the world today. And it's not a paradox. It's two sides of the same coin, figuring out how you work with and deal with other people. And in that sense, it is a moral system. And Madison, in closing, was right. James Madison, the father of our Constitution, said if men were angels, we'd not need laws, we'd not need government. Manifestly, we're not angels, except maybe grandchildren, and they only to a certain age. and then, so we do need. But it's one thing to say you don't go 100 miles an hour in a school zone. quite another to tell people what to drive, where to drive. And so the common sense goes a long way. But in terms of arguing for free markets, make the moral case. It allows creativity. It allows a guy like Jobs, abandoned by his biological parents, to funnel his anger and his energies and his genius in a very constructive way that benefits all of us. That's the thing to keep in mind. It just doesn't work. It works because it appeals, as Lincoln put it, to the better angels of our nature, even if we're thinking just we're doing it for ourselves. You're actually doing it for others, and you don't even fully realize it.
Well, unfortunately, we have time for just one more question. Your vision of the future is very clear. I grew up in Chicago. This is a very important time of year and a very important time in Cubs history. Is this the year that they win the World Series?
Yeah. Since my Yankees were just hoping to get in the third wild card, and so, you know, getting eliminated after one game after the season. Oh, great victory. We made it. Yeah, if it ain't the Yankees, and I know this is Giants town, but you've won three times, so, you know. talk about sharing and the economy. It's an anomaly, and there are theories about whether it's Wrigley Park and all those day games, why for 108 years the Cubs haven't won a World Series. And among professional sports, it's absolutely unheard of. And as George Will, who's a Cub fan, said, every team can have a bad century. But this has gone beyond a century. This is now 108 years, 110 years. So, yeah, let's get this out of the way, and maybe this will unleash all the good things that I talked about. Now that the Cubs have got their bugaboo out of the way and they win a championship, anything can be possible. The Cubs can win. Anything is possible.
Right. Well, I want to thank you, Steve Forbes, for joining us today. And I hope all of our listeners and readers have a chance to read your book, Reviving America, How Repealing Obamacare, Replacing the Tax Code, and Reforming the Fed Will Restore Hope and Prosperity. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. A reminder to everyone here in the room, Mr. Forbes has to leave immediately after this presentation to catch a plane. So we appreciate if you remain in your seats until he's left the room. I'm Duff Sunheim, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. And this is like the coolest thing I've done in years.